Our final case this morning is 2021-754, Disciplinary Counsel versus Sean Richard Porter. For the respondent, we have Ms. Wilson.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. My name is Holly Marie Wilson. I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, Sean Porter.
Also, if you pull the microphone a little closer, we can.
Is that better?
Thank you.
Sure. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. There are three main factors supporting a lesser degree of discipline than what was recommended by the board. The first concerns the impact of COVID on these proceedings. We're clearly living in unprecedented times, and it's widely reported that access to mental health care has been impacted by the COVID pandemic. The same holds true here today for Sean. Now, this was demonstrated twice below when Sean had to file a motion to continue the proceedings because he could not obtain expert testimony. He could not obtain expert testimony because of the impact of the pandemic. Despite contacting OLAP in November of 2019, it was not until April of 2020 that Sean was able to secure an appointment with a mental health care provider, an initial evaluation, and undergo a course of treatment. That treatment was obviously abbreviated because of the time frame that we're dealing with here. Now, in addition to the two motions that were filed below, Sean also testified at the hearing regarding the fact that there was a delay in seeking treatment because of COVID. Finally, on this point, this court has previously noted that due to the limited amount of time between the filing of a grievance and the occurrence of a disciplinary hearing, it is often difficult, even under the best of circumstances, to find a provider and undergo treatment required to meet the mitigating factors. Sean, however, in this case, was able to engage with a highly qualified medical professional, one who specializes in Sean's particular affliction. That mental health professional, Ms. LeMasters, testified that it is highly unlikely that Sean will engage in repeating past behaviors given his ongoing treatment. She also directly correlated his actions with his clients and his initial missteps with the disciplinary counsel to his mental health needs. For this reason, and because the disorder directly contributed to his behavior with his clients, Sean is entitled to the full mitigating weight of his condition and the fact that he sought treatment and is actively treating for his condition. The second factor supporting a lesser disciplinary measure concerns consent. We can agree that consent is immaterial in determining if there has been a Rule 1.8J violation. That's not what's being argued here. That's not what was being argued below. Instead, when you look at all of the disciplinary decisions from this court, consent is discussed in some manner. So below, Sean's defense was not premised on consent. It was not premised on any victim blaming. Instead, at the conclusion of his direct, he was asked a question by a panel member. That panel member asked him who initiated the sexual conduct. Sean, faced with a question, answered it truthfully. He did not prevaricate. He indicated that it was his clients who initiated the contact. However, almost immediately after that, he made very clear that, regardless of who initiated the contact, he, as the attorney, had the duty to say, no, this is not proper, and Sean freely admitted that he did not take that final step. Now, when relying on this testimony, answering a direct question from a panel member, the panel and the board then accepted that testimony and characterized it as victim blaming and refusal to accept responsibility for his actions. Again, Sean answered a direct question. It was not part of his defense. It was not part of the presentation. He answered a question truthfully. His clients were above the age of consent. Indeed, they were older than he. They were not indigent. They were not court appointed. And they clearly had their choice of counsel. Looking at this conduct and these facts, we don't have the same situation than we did in Slaby, where we have one client who accused her attorney of rape and another client who had to change her telephone number and her email address to escape unwanted advances. Slaby is one of the cases that the panel looked at in supporting its disciplinary recommendations. Those facts are clearly not present here. Finally, the third factor supporting a lesser disciplinary measure concerns the panel's criticism of Sean for engaging in the discovery process. The panel equates Sean's availing himself of the right to discovery as, quote, a lack of cooperation in the disciplinary process, end quote. The disciplinary rules promulgated by this court afford Sean and other respondents the right to conduct discovery. It's a due process issue. Engaging in discovery is not a lack of cooperation. It's certainly not an aggravating factor. It is simply someone who's following the rules and asking for the discovery that they are entitled to. For these reasons, we believe that the panel's disciplinary recommendations are excessive, and we ask that this court reconsider. And if there are no further questions, I can field the rest of my time at rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I do have one question. What your position is that the sanction should be lesser?
Yes, ma'am.
And what would you suggest is appropriate and why?
We have agreed with the 2-year suspension. We ask that 18 months be stayed. We also are not challenging any of the post-suspension controls, which in this case are significant. Continuing cooperation with OLAP, continuing mental health care and treatment by Ms. LeMasters or another provider who's equally qualified, and most importantly, a mentoring attorney assigned by the relator who is going to monitor every single one of Sean's interactions with every female attorney in person, in writing, telephone, email, for 2 years. Those are significant sanctions. We are not opposing any of that.
You meant female clients.
Female
attorneys.
Sorry, female
I do
attorney.
Have a question. At first, he denied it all, right?
Absolutely.
Why should we not believe the panel then that he wasn't cooperating?
I think there's a fundamental difference when we look at the disciplinary holdings of this court between initial uncooperative behavior and then moving forward with the process. There was no misstatements under oath. It was in his initial responses to the grievance. Sean testified he was scared. It was a knee-jerk reaction. He made a bad choice. He admitted to that bad choice and indeed agreed to the multiple offenses that he was charged with. There was no objection to the offenses. Instead, the objection was the measure of discipline, and that's why we're here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kanai?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. Sean Porter committed 2 acts of misconduct, each of which this court has held separately warrant and the imposition of an actual suspension. First, he had an improper sexual relationship with two vulnerable clients, and second, he has committed multiple acts of deceit, dishonesty, and misrepresentation. The board correctly reviewed the facts in this case and looked at the relevant case law and imposed or recommended a sanction of 2 years with 1 year stayed and reinstatement subject to condition. Mr. Porter now objects to those of findings and to the sanction, but in doing so, he is essentially engaging in the same shifting of blame that he has been doing throughout this litigation. That blame shifting began in the investigatory process when he not only denied his improper sexual relationship with his second client, AH, but he engaged in what the board characterized as character assassination and victim blaming in doing so. He claimed that AH had mental health problems, that she was acting on emotion, and essentially characterized her as a vindictive liar. He actually said in his response to the grievance, which was a 3-page typewritten response, that she had an evil motive towards him. He did this knowing full and well that every representation he was making was a lie, and he later admitted to that at the hearing, that he had completely fabricated his response. But he stuck to that lie until after he had deposed AH, forced her to take multiple days off of work and turn over hundreds of pages of text messages a mere month before the hearing on this case. That is why the board found that he was not cooperative in the disciplinary process. And that is part of the reason why the board concluded that he has not taken responsibility for his misconduct. He at no point showed any remorse towards his clients at the hearing. And the board also found that he has attempted to shift blame both to his clients and to his former law firm, which he has claimed to this court both under-supervised him and overworked him, as if that somehow provides an explanation for his misconduct. Further, even in his briefing to this court, rather than take responsibility for his own failures, he attacked the Board of Professional Conduct, claiming that it acted inappropriately and highly prejudiced towards him, because he claims that they failed to give him credit for an issue that he never raised at the hearing. Even a first-year attorney knows that if you want to make an issue of a fact or a series of facts at a hearing, it's your responsibility to raise those issues. Mr. Porter made one comment about COVID during the entire hearing, and it was in response to the board's question when they asked him if he could explain his interaction with OLAP. He said, "I tried to contact them and get a preferred provider, but because of COVID and stuff like that, it got, quote, kind of delayed." Now he comes to this court and claims for the first time that he started meeting with OLAP in November of 2019, but he never put that information in front of the board, yet he feels comfortable lambasting the board for its failure to recognize an issue he never raised. This is just another example of his lack of taking responsibility for his actions. And this court has previously addressed that type of behavior by attorneys. In Disciplinary Counsel versus Sturgeon, the court noted that Sturgeon's dishonesty, combined with his blaming of his clients and his refusal to accept responsibility for his own misconduct, demonstrated his lack of fitness to practice in a profession that is grounded in the concepts of candor, integrity, loyalty, and fairness. Mr. Porter has blamed everyone but himself. He has blamed his clients, his former employers, and the Board of Professional Conduct. And by doing so, he has demonstrated the same disregard for those four key watchwords of our profession. The board obviously did not know that it would be attacked at these proceedings in front of this court, but it was prescient and understanding that Mr. Porter would not accept responsibility for his actions. And that is why, looking at the facts of this case and the relevant case law, it determined that the appropriate sanction was 2 years with 1 year stayed.
Counselor, but I thought that you're saying he's not accepting responsibility for his actions, but as counsel said, he is. He disputes the sanction.
He does, Your Honor. But the relevant case law establishes that the sanction is completely appropriate for this type of offense. Mr. Porter's primary argument, even today, is that his sanction should be less than the sanction that the court imposed in Slaby. But the board's recommendation is less than the sanction that the board imposed in Slaby. Slaby received a 2-year sanction with 6 months stayed. We are asking for a 2-year suspension with 12 months stayed. And so even under that logic, he hasn't presented an actual argument to this court. The most similar case, and the one that the board recognized, is Disciplinary Counsel versus Benbow, which is strikingly similar to the facts of this case. Benbow self-reported, but like Mr. Porter, he only did so after he was caught. Benbow had an inappropriate sexual relationship with a vulnerable client, like Mr. Porter. He attempted to hide that inappropriate sexual relationship, like Mr. Porter, and then he lied about it during the investigation. The only factor that really mitigates for Mr. Porter when compared to Benbow is that Benbow lied under oath. But there are two significant issues that equalize that weight. First, Mr. Porter not only lied during the investigation, but he attacked his vulnerable client, claimed that she was a liar, knowing full and well that she was not. He forced her into a deposition, which, granted, he had every right to do. Or he could have just taken responsibility for the conduct that he knew was a lie. The other factor that is extremely important in this case when balancing Benbow is that Mr. Porter slept with not one, but two vulnerable clients in the span of a week. And when the panel asked Mr. Porter if he had not learned anything from his first act of misconduct, he readily admitted that he had not. And it appears that he still has not learned how to take responsibility for his misconduct. Benbow and Mr. Porter both had two mitigating circumstances found by the board. They both had no prior disciplinary record, and Benbow had character references. Mr. Porter, on the other hand, did make restitution to his firm for his misconduct. They also had similar, essentially identical aggravating factors. The court noted in Benbow that the board had found 6 aggravating factors and had mentioned the factor of failing to take responsibility for his actions, although it didn't make a formal finding. Mr. Porter had those same 6, plus the failure to take responsibility for his actions, found by the board. So we have similar facts, essentially identical aggravating factors, and the same number of mitigating factors. The sanction in Benbow is therefore appropriate in this case because it is both recent and binding precedent, and because it is essentially the same type of case for the same type of misconduct with the same type of aggravating circumstances. So for these reasons, we would ask the court to adopt the recommendations of the Board of Professional Conduct and impose its recommended sanction. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I would yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Ms. Wilson.
A few quick points, Your Honor. Number one, and most importantly, disagreeing with the board is not an attack. It is a respectful disagreement as to the measure of discipline. Conducting discovery below, permitted by the rules, is not a failure to cooperate with the process. And it's certainly not putting any undue influence on any party. The rules provide discovery. Sean conducted discovery. He's now being punished for it, and it's being called a lack of cooperation.
Didn't he characterize the board as being biased against him and, you know, some other descriptions?
There were disagreements with the board's findings, yes. Feeling that the board mischaracterized his testimony at the hearing and his conduct in conducting discovery. Yes, those were absolutely disagreements. It's also important to realize here, Sean stipulated to the violations. That is, in by definition, cooperation. He's identified his rule violations. He's freely admitted to them. In fact, he stipulated them. No one had to prove them. He went into that hearing stipulating what he did wrong. Instead, he had a disagreement regarding the length of the discipline. That's why we have these hearings. That's why we go through this process. Because you can't have an honest disagreement as to what prior case law says, especially in this situation where we don't have a fact scenario that fits very neatly into one box or another box. When you look at the prior disciplinary decisions involving defense counsel, we see instances where it's a court-appointed defense counsel for an indigent client. We have clients testifying that they felt they had to perform sexually or they had to give in to their attorney's demands or requests because they felt it would otherwise jeopardize their defense. You don't have that testimony in this case. So by bringing those facts to the forefront, again, that's not attacking a victim. That's not blaming someone else. That's just saying this situation is different from what has come before. As far as comparing this case to Slaby, Sean is not arguing that the discipline in Slaby is similar or should be the same or is different. Instead, we're talking about the conduct. What was the conduct that we saw in Slaby? Was it similar to the conduct we see here? The answer is no, it is not. For that reason, even though the discipline in Slaby is different than the discipline recommended here, we think it was telling that the board chose to focus on Slaby in its decision because the facts are so very, very different and the conduct is so very, very different. As far as testimony regarding Sean being overworked, not having an appropriate mentor, again, this is not victim blaming, and this is not trying to foist responsibility onto someone else. Instead, it has to do with Sean's condition. Anxiety, depression, those conditions are exacerbated by the fact that Sean was overworked and was not mentored at his former firm. So again, it's not shifting blame, it's explaining that you had a perfect storm at his first place of employment that aggravated his existing mental health conditions. Is Sean accepting responsibility for his actions? Yes, of course. But in defending himself, mitigating factors should be considered. Those were mitigating factors.
But he went to work for his father and it occurred again, correct? Over here. He went to work for his father and it occurred again, correct?
The
you talked about mentoring. I figured a father could probably mentor as well as anyone else.
Correct. And the relationship with MH was terminated in October before Sean went to work for his father. The attorney-client relationship with AH was also terminated in October before Sean went to work for his father. After the termination of the attorney-client relationship, the personal relationship with AH did continue. But once the attorney-client relationship terminated, there was nothing pro se inappropriate about the relationship between the two. So yes, Sean did continue a relationship with AH after she was no longer his attorney, and that relationship continued till, I believe, March. So some months after Sean went to work for his father.
Thank you.
The agreed aggravating factors in this case were multiple offenses, submission of false evidence. Sean agreed to those aggravating factors. The board found additional aggravating factors, many of which Sean is not disagreeing with. Instead, the few factors that we are disagreeing with are the lack of cooperation. Again, it's premised on Sean participating in discovery, exercising his right to discovery. That's not an aggravating factor. That's not a lack of cooperation. Refusal to acknowledge wrongful nature of conduct. Again, at the hearing, Sean was not blaming his clients. He was asked a direct question about who initiated the sexual conduct. He answered that question truthfully. That's not a refusal to acknowledge wrongful conduct, and it's certainly not an aggravating factor here. As for mitigating factors, two were agreed upon, and several were rejected. The full and free disclosure is the mitigating factor that we are challenging. Again, the board held that Sean's actions were tainted by his refusal to acknowledge multiple offenses. Again, Sean stipulated to the offenses. There was no denial of his conduct. Instead, defending his actions, discussing his mental health condition, and answering questions about what his clients did or said is not stepping away from or failing to take responsibility for his actions. For those reasons, we ask that this court adopt a 2-year suspension with 18 months stayed. We accept all the conditions laid out by the board. Thank you for your time
Thank
today.
You. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.